Armistead Maupin is a social satirist. His primary subject is love, gay, straight, and in between. His new novel, Sure of You, completes his six-volume saga, Tales of the City. Set in San Francisco, it chronicles life in the 70s and 80s, cruising bars, cruising supermarkets, lesbian separatist music festivals, house husbands, the new baby boom, promiscuous heterosexuals, alternate families, cult groups, talk show pop psychology, the gentrification of the Tenderloin, and AIDS. Maupin's novels evolved from his San Francisco newspaper serial, which he began in 1976. Armistead Maupin grew up in a politically conservative family in Raleigh, North Carolina. After he moved to San Francisco in 1971, he came out and became a gay activist. I asked him to read an excerpt from his new book, Sure of You.
This is a letter that Michael Tolliver, a gay man in San Francisco who's HIV positive, writes to his mother in Florida. It's a difficult letter for him to write, so he stops at various points throughout the letter and begins again. Dear Mama, when you were talking about Papa's headstone the other day, I noticed you mentioned there was room at the plot for the entire family. No, awkward, start again. Dear Mama, it was wonderful talking to you the other day. Thack says you and I should talk more, and I guess he's right, since it always makes me feel better. Stop lying and get to the point. Dear Mama, I'm glad we talked the other day. There was something you mentioned, though, that concerned me. You seemed to think that someday the whole family would be buried at the cemetery there. I know how you meant this, but frankly, the idea of Christian burial strikes me as unnecessary and a little ghoulish. Real subtle, Tolliver. Keep writing. You can change it later. I don't know how much time I have left, whether it's 2 years or 5 or 50, but I don't want to be taken back to Orlando when it's over. This is my home now, and I've asked Thack to make arrangements for my cremation here in San Francisco. This wouldn't be so important to me if I didn't believe in families just as much as you do. I have one of my own, and it means the world to me. If there are goodbyes to be said, I want them to be here, and I want Thack to be in charge. I hope you can understand. If you still want to do a memorial service in Orlando, assuming you can't come here, Thack can send you part of the ashes. I think you know I'd prefer not to have a preacher involved, but do whatever makes you feel comfortable. Just make sure he doesn't pray for my soul or ask the Lord's forgiveness or anything like that. Please don't get the wrong idea. I'm fine right now. I just wanted this to be out of the way so we don't have to think about it again. I'm not too worried about how you'll take it since I know how much you like Thack. He sends his love, by the way, and promises to send pics of the new chairs as soon as we get them painted. I'll try to call more often. All my love, Michael. P.S. My friend Marianne Singleton, you met her once years ago, has a new syndicated morning talk show. It starts in March, so watch for it. She's a good friend of mine, and we're all really happy for her.
Armistead Maupin reading from his new book, which is the last book in the Tales of the City series. Have you watched a lot of people suffer through writing similar letters to their parents explaining that they didn't want funeral arrangements in their hometown, that they wanted their family, even if it wasn't an official marriage type of family, to be respected?
Yes, actually, this particular idea came directly from my lover, Terry, who's HIV positive and who had some of the same concerns. Michael jokes in the book that he doesn't want a funeral where they set him up in the living room next to the spinning wheel with the philodendron growing on it. And that's a very real concern for a lot of gay men, that they would be drawn back into a world that they are no longer part of after their deaths, and they want they're leaving this world to reflect their lives in the world.
So Terry wrote this kind of letter to his parents?
He's spoken to his parents and made it clear that he wants to stay in San Francisco. And actually, he came up with the idea of dividing the ashes, feeling, well, if they had to do something, then some of the ashes could be sent home. I should hasten to add that Terry's perfectly healthy, and we hope he's going to be around for a long time, but you can't help but think about these things when you're HIV positive, and you want them out of the way early so they're not of concern to you should you get sick.
Now, the character in your novel who writes the letter that you just read for us is at some point in the novel propositioned by a famous designer, a man who's a famous designer, you know, but that this man has just been written about in all the big magazines because at the Biddy Ford Center, he fell in love with someone who worked there, and now they're perfectly, you know, they're the happy couple in, like, the perfect feature story way of, of happy married life. And, of course, he's in the closet. He's gay. And the character who wrote this letter, Michael, who is propositioned by him, is furious that he's not out, you know, that this designer isn't out. This seems to be, like, something that's important to you. Famous people, especially people in the world of entertainment, who stay in the closet.
Yes, it's enormous concern to me. I feel that one of the reasons that homophobia is still so rampant in America is that most Americans have no idea how many of their heroes are homosexual. So we have a terrible cycle here of deceit where we continue to lie to the public about who we are, and as a consequence, homophobia continues to rage. We've seen 50,000 people die now because of that kind of ignorance. So it's no longer an adequate to me to say this is a career consideration and this is something I'm allowed to do. Either homosexuality is okay or it isn't. We have to make up our minds how we feel about it. And if it's okay, then it should be as matter of fact as the color of our eyes or our hair or where we go to church.
Sure of You, your new novel, is dedicated to the British actor Ian McKellen, who came out within the past few years. I forget exactly when it was, but I think he's one of the first or one of the few actors of his generation to come out.
Yes.
In England.
It was last year, and he came out essentially to fight Clause 28, an English law which was tacked on to a finance bill, actually. That said essentially that the government could withhold funds from anyone found to be promoting homosexuality, whatever that means. Ian saw that it could be interpreted to exclude you know, some of the greatest plays in history and grew very angry about it.
Why did you dedicate the book to him?
Well, Ian's been a friend for 6 or 7 years now. He came to San Francisco several years ago when he was doing his acting Shakespeare tour. And the first night we were together, he called me and my lover Terry and my best friend Steve Beery together and said, what do you think? Should I come out of the closet? I thought he was, he's a charming man and I love him very much, and I thought he was asking me this because he knew that it was close to my heart, and I really didn't think that he was going to act on it because I'd never seen anyone else act on it. And he did, and says that his life has been changed dramatically. He feels as if he's taken charge of his life for the first time. He was worried that the tabloids were going to get a hold of him and do something terrible, and he learned a very valuable lesson, which is when you come out yourself, when you declare yourself, you are no longer susceptible to scandal in that way. It's not a scandal. It's a big ho-hum.
Did you give him any advice when you had that conversation?
I told him yes. I thought that it would change his life and that it would make a big difference to everybody, and that I thought people, especially famous people, have a moral responsibility to be open about who they are.
Am I right in saying that you had canceled Rock Hudson also, that he should come out?
In 76.
Comparatively long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. I thought it would be possible for him at that point, be easier for him at that point, because he had already established himself. I mean, certainly by 76, he was a very rich man. He was no longer really playing romantic leads, although I'm not even sure that's an excuse. And I knew it would make a lot of difference to people. And I've always believed, because I think I myself am an example of it, if you take charge of it yourself, if you say, this is nothing I am ashamed of, this is who I am, then you force people into the position of accepting your version of things. And I knew that Rock Hudson could do that. I figured that he would be, I told him I could foresee a time that he would be on the cover of every American magazine because he was being honest about himself. Now, of course, that happened, but it happened very late and under very sad circumstances, but he did do it.
Now, you're in the opposite position of people who are well-known and in the closet, because you've been out ever since since before you started your writing career as a novelist and your writing career syndicating the stories that became the Tales of the City book. You're about to embark on a book tour. You're going to be traveling with your lover, Terry Anderson. What are some of the things that you have to confront on a book tour, when you're both out, but you have to deal with hotel reservations and booking the tour, all the stuff, dealing with the publishers.
Well, for one thing, the hotel reservations require a special letter from the from each of the hotels we visit, because we found over the years, almost unfailingly, when we request a double bed, or rather a queen or a king sized bed in our hotel room, that someone on the other end, behind the desk at the hotel, sees that two men are staying in that room and change it to two twin beds or two double beds. They do this because they're used to getting protestations, I guess, from heterosexual men traveling together who don't want to sleep in the same bed. And as a consequence, we invariably have to add 30 or 45 minutes on to a visit to a hotel where they shift us, during which time they shift us to the proper kind of bed. So it's a very frustrating experience. Even when you're out, the world continues to presume that you're not.
One of the characters in your book says that he doesn't want to become a Hare Krishna to other gays. What does he mean by that?
Well, I guess that particular character, I guess Michael says it, means that he doesn't want to have to always be talking about it. I feel that frustration myself. Terry and I joke about what we refer to as gay 101, constantly having to explain the same things over and over again. But when you put yourself out there and make it someone of cause, that you end up having to do it. And I'm not sorry. I'm glad I took it on, because it's something that caused me a great deal of pain when I was a teenager, and even later. And I don't want that to be the case for other people. I think that by being more direct and honest, that I can sort of fix it, so we don't have to talk endlessly about this in the future. We can just all be people and love other people, and it doesn't. It's no longer an issue.
Sure Review is the last and sixth book in your Tales of the City series. Why did you decide to end it, and is it any coincidence that it's also the end of the decade?
I think that is a coincidence. I think I'm just ready to end it. It feels right to me. I have other projects that I want to get on to. And I also felt that the characters had grown to a point that it seemed like an end of an era for them.
What happens to you as the creator of all these characters when you leave them after so many years?
It is kind of like raising children and sending them off into the world, because I do feel like they have a life of their own now. And it will be sort of odd, I imagine, 3 or 4 years from now to speculate as to what they might be doing when I'm not writing about them. I can't tell you yet. Maybe I'll go through terrible withdrawal symptoms. I did after the second book, actually, when I resolved to stop it after the second book. I had a dream in which Mrs. Madrigal, the landlady, came into my room and sat on the edge of the bed and sort of shook my foot and said, "So you're leaving us, huh?" And I began to realize to what degree these people were so much a part of my life. The books really have served as a kind of shrink for me, I think, because each of the characters is a fragment of my personality. I lean on different sides of my personality when writing about them. So if they've matured or not matured over the years, those are really comments on where I've gone in those ways.
But can we talk a little bit about how your life has changed since the series began? You started writing these stories in 1976?
Right. Technically, in 1974, I ran some of the chapters in a Marin publication called The Pacific Sun. Marianne Singleton started out in 1974.
How long had you been in San Francisco then?
3 years.
And what started you writing these things?
I was writing nonfiction, actually. I went to the Marina Safeway in an effort to write a nonfiction feature story on the straight cruising scene that occurred at that grocery store. And I couldn't get any of the men or women who were there done up to the nines with, three items in their grocery cart to admit to me that they were there to pick up somebody of the opposite sex. So I went back and made up Marianne Singleton and thought that an ironic end to the story would be that she would find the man that she liked and he would turn out to be there with another man. And the editors liked the idea so much that they said, why don't you keep writing it? Take them somewhere else next week and let's see what happens to them. And the story just kind of grew from there. And the characters began interacting with each other in ways that I had never dreamed.
I'm gonna ask you about this, since you've been kind of chronicling life in San Francisco through the books. How has nightlife changed in the gay community in the past few years?
Well, I'm kind of the wrong guy to ask that,
right,
because I'm
right.
A stodgy old 45-year-old now with a husband of 4 years.
And, so this has nothing to do with writing, anyways.
And we really don't go out. One night we felt really guilty about the fact that we weren't going out. He's in the booth there laughing at you, I can tell.
He's in the control room laughing, yeah.
And, but we went out to a place called the Rawhide 2 one night, which is very popular right now. It's a kind of country western place that I write about in Shoreview. And it was charming. I was really completely delighted because it was a total mix of people, gay and straight and lesbian and all ages. And the book, I say, it looked like the commuters on a BART train had suddenly begun to dance with each other. And it was a delightful San Francisco phenomenon, which I wouldn't mind doing again. I couldn't tell you about the rest. They have things called boy clubs now that are sort of young, you know, 25-ish gay male dance clubs where the patrons pride themselves on being antibody negative. But I don't go there. For obvious reasons.
You know, you mentioned this place, the Rawhide 2, and that reminds me, once in Manhattan, I was waiting to get into a jazz club, and it wasn't time yet. And I was just walking around, and I needed a pair of boots. And I see this place called the Rawhide, and I thought, I bet they have nice boots. And I went in there, and of course, it's like lots of men with drinks in their hands.
Right.
Boy, have I come to the wrong place. I was wondering if you ever saw someone like me walk in at the wrong time.
Well, the Rawhide 2, you'd have no problem. I mean, I can't imagine who would be out of place
right.
at the Rawhide 2. In fact, there's a 70-year-old woman in Shoreview who's there leading the dancing. That's one of the things that I've noticed, that because a lot of mothers especially came out to San Francisco to be with their sons when AIDS struck, and because those sons have yet to die, you find that there are a lot of these parents who are actually involved in the gay community in San Francisco and having a ball, having more fun than their sons who are, you know, probably kind of think of these festivities as being old hat.
I wonder what effect you've had on your parents, who I think your father especially, and forgive me because I'm not sure that they're living, but I know that he had been, or still is, I don't know, very, very conservative.
Very, yes. He is still living. My mother died about 10 years ago. My father is a conservative lawyer living in Raleigh, North Carolina. His law firm is the law firm that runs the Congressional Club, the money-raising arm of Jesse Helms and the New Right. When my mother died, Jesse Helms read a eulogy to her on the floor of the Senate. They're that close. So I have a very difficult time still in communicating with my father on any political issue. We love each other, and I know that he loves me, and he knows I love him, but he's in his 70s, and he's not going to change, and I'm certainly not going to change. So we go round from time to time. I went back to Raleigh 2 years ago to participate, a year ago, I guess, to participate in Raleigh's first gay pride march, and we led a march of several thousand people down the main street to the Capitol building, past the monument that was erected by my great-grandmother to the Confederate soldiers of the city. And I made a speech on the steps of the Capitol, during which I, you know, condemned Jesse Helms and the whole homophobic structure of that city. And it was a very odd experience for me to come home, to come back to that place and feel good about myself, because I had suffered so much as a child over what I was, and to realize after many years that you did that for no reason. You did that because of ignorance and because other people didn't tell you that you were all right. It's an amazing discovery to make.
I guess I'm curious to hear why you think your father hasn't changed at all, in the sense that if he's working for things that are very anti-gay, I mean, if no one else, he's got you as an example. I mean, shouldn't he be thinking that maybe it's time to rethink his views on this?
I think he might have. I don't know. Part of my problem is I have a stepmother who's my age, who is more homophobic than he is.
Really?
And I think that she's had some effect on him in that way. I'm not sure. He's able to deal with me and love me personally. He actually loves Terry, I think. I mean, the times that he's come out to visit, he's shown real affection towards Terry and sort of kidded him about how he thought Terry was the best thing that had happened to me. But it's on the broader... He's not willing to defend me, I guess is what he's saying. Not really to stand up for it. He's not willing to turn to Jesse Helms and say, you're full of crap. And I think he knows on some level that Jesse is, but he doesn't know how to fight that battle yet. And if anything, he gave me a kind of toughness. I can fight it. I don't mind. I mean, I can make all the noise that he can't make at this point. But he comes from a generation that may not change. I had an editor tell me once that at the Chronicle, who said, you know, your problems aren't going to be over until my generation is dead. Well, that used to sound kind of hopeful to me. All we had to do is wait for them to die out. But there are 20-year-old homophobes out there today. And the situation won't change at all until people make a noise about it.
Armisen Maupin, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.